Well, my argument is you don't think like a Christian and then maybe do Christian. You think and do simultaneously. Christianity is not just a way of thinking, it's a way of life.
Well, hey friends, it's Jason, and I want to thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Canadian Church Leaders Podcast. The heart of the Canadian Church Leaders Network is to strengthen pastors. And we want to create a forum for us to wrestle with questions like, what does it mean to be a pastor in this place and in this time? And while most of our work is through digital channels like the podcast, every once in a while we get to gather in person in different ways. And coming up in the next couple of weeks, we're gathering for the Canadian Youth Pastor Summit out east, March 5 to 7 in Mississauga, Ontario. And our hope is to see youth pastors supported and cared for and to invest in those who long to see the next generation come alive in Jesus. And we'd love to see you there. If that is part of your portfolio at work, come and join us for this awesome gathering. And if you've hung up your youth ministry hat or can't make it out, would you take a moment and pray for us as we gather with youth pastors from across Eastern Canada? Pray that God would move in great power to refresh their hearts and that God would give wisdom to each pastor as they do the extremely important work of discipling the next generation. Okay, in today's episode, I get to sit down and talk with Jerry Sitzer. And I first met Jerry a few years ago, and I've been so drawn to him and his work ever since. And so I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time. And I don't think I've given away more copies of a book than I have his book, A Grace Disguised. It's a book that speaks to those who are experiencing great suffering and loss. And it's been a book that I've been able to give that's been met as like a lifeline or a companion for those going through grief. Let me tell you a bit about Jerry. Jerry's been a professor emeritus of theology and senior fellow at Whitworth University, specializing in the history of Christianity, Christian spirituality, and religion in American public life. He is now retired and spends much of his time with his 11 grandchildren. He has written 9 books. Among them are A Grace Disguised, which I mentioned, The Will of God as a Way of Life, and Water from a Deep Well. And his most recent book, Resilient Faith, How the Early Christian Third Way Changed the World, explores how the early Christian movement developed such a clear and unique identity in the ancient world, and against all odds grew into a formidable force long before Christianity became a legalized, recognized religion. And we had the opportunity to discuss some of these themes in his books and more. We talked about how the life and practices of the early Christian church speaks to how we can thrive in our modern context. We talked about why and how the erosion of Christendom today is both a challenge we face, but also a gift for followers of Jesus in our time. And he shared about his journey of carrying deep grief and pain. Jerry defines his calling as serving as a bridge between the academy and the church. And you'll see how this comes out in our conversation. And just a little note, I recorded this in my home on a snow day here in Vancouver. And so you might hear the sound of children downstairs or the street from behind us. I thought I'd let you know. And if you check it out on YouTube, you'll see this beautiful scene of Vancouver covered in snow. Hey, and before we jump into today's conversation, we have one of our friends, Jay, pastors at Redwood Park Church in Thunder Bay, sharing with us about how their church has been working with our partner, the Canadian Bible Society's Bible course, and the impact it's had on their community.
As a pastor, I'm always looking for ways to help the community that I shepherd read, understand, and fall in love with God's Word. I deeply believe that Scripture is the primary place that we hear God speak and therefore know how to live our lives in a way that helps us and others to flourish. The difficulty I've encountered over the years as a pastor is that many people feel that the Bible is out of touch, hard to understand, and no longer even relevant in our current society. And I believe God's Word is the most relevant thing we have. I want others in my church community and beyond to come to that understanding as well. And so I have longed for something to come along to help me, to help my congregation, to fall in love with God's Word, to grow in their understanding of it, and to see how the big story informs all other stories, including theirs. So we offered the Bible course for the first time last year. It was incredible. We had so many people from our church sign up for the course and then report back that it was life-changing for them. They understood for the first time how each part of the Bible fit in with the whole. They grew in their appreciation of God's word and indicated to me that it was helping them to actually want to pick up their Bible and read. In fact, one of the young adults from our church who took the Bible course said, "I come away from attending the Bible course with a renewed appreciation for my church community and the confidence to read the Bible with a deeper understanding of its context. As a follower of Jesus, for the majority of my life, there is still always more for me to learn about him, his word, and what he has planned for me." What an encouragement. I am so grateful for the Bible course. It was easy to run in our church, and we are committed to offer it going forward. Our people are growing in their faith, and the Bible course is a big part of that story.
Do you guys have snow in Washington today?
We have very heavy snow right now, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, us as well. If you hear, I'm home, I'm not at the office as I usually would be. My children are kindly downstairs watching a show or something. So there might be a very welcome interruption at some point. When it's getting intense, maybe they'll come and
I just picked up a granddaughter about 2 hours ago because she was sick, and she was here till 15 minutes ago when her mother picked her up. So we do this kind of thing, you know.
How many grandchildren do you have now?
I have 11.
Whoa.
And nine.
And are they close by to you?
Nine live within 5 minutes of our house.
What a gift.
Isn't that remarkable? And of those nine, actually of our 11 grandchildren, nine of them are between the ages of 18 months and 7 years.
So, wow, so that's busy.
We see them quite often, yeah.
How did you guys spend Christmas this year? Were you able to be together?
We are every Christmas, sometimes before, sometimes after, and it's delightful chaos because when we're all together, there are 23 of us. And you know, most of these are little people who are very young. It's a delight. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, grateful that you'd make time to be with us today. Such a joy. These days, what primarily has your imagination, your creativity, and your energy, besides grandchildren and those kind of relationships, where do you find your creative, passionate energy going towards?
Well, there are a number of things, actually. I mean, one of the lovely parts of retirement is that you can kind of do what God calls you to do, not as much within the confines of traditional institutions, like churches or universities or businesses or whatever. So you're a little freer. So I divide my time up into quite a bit of time with grandchildren. I mean, for the grandchildren living in town, 9 out of 11, I see each of them individually at least once every 2 weeks. Do something with them. They're over here. And some I do childcare on top of that. But that's one. I spend a lot of time with young pastors in town. That's another one of my callings. And I have a reading group with them as well. And then I write. Right now I'm actually writing a new catechumenate.
Like
the old one. And Johnny, by the way, Johnny Hughes is actually reading it right now and is quite interested in using it. It's kind of the next step beyond Alpha. And very theologically, but from first chapter to the end, it's all oriented toward practice and application. Yeah. So my argument is you don't think like a Christian and then maybe do Christian. You think and do simultaneously. Christianity is not just a way of thinking, it's a way of life.
And that would be the primary distinction then. Hey, like we're more familiar with the word catechism.
Yeah.
Somehow catechumenate is kind of lost in the archive, but it's different. Give us that distinction. I think it's really important.
Yeah, catechism would be what the Reformation produced. the major feature being a right thinking about theology and about the Bible, and notice that they did that over against other Christian groups. They weren't thinking about people who are secular, because in the 16th century, you'd probably find 1 out of 1,000 people who did not profess to be Christian. And they would be considered heretics, not necessarily non-Christian, except for Jews and Muslims. But they were so isolated, they didn't play that big a role in that time. Now, of course, times have changed. So back then it would be, I'm Reformed as opposed to Lutheran, or I'm Anabaptist, or I'm Catholic, or I'm Anglican. And they all produce their own series of catechisms to indoctrinate or introduce people to a particular way of thinking theologically. There was some practice involved, but it was mostly information oriented. And I think we're in a period now in our larger history in the West of moving beyond a Christendom to a very different period of history. Certainly you experienced this in a city like Vancouver, and in most large cities across the United States, and even more so in Europe, we're becoming increasingly post-Christian, not just post-Christendom. And the rise of nuns in America, for example, the drop in church attendance are all signs. There are many signs, actually, where Christianity is losing its place of privilege in the larger culture. And so for us to define a Christian over against a Catholic or Reformed or Lutheran seems meaningless to me now. The early catechumenate in the first few centuries of the church's life was oriented toward introducing them to the very foundational principles of Christianity and how you live that out in daily life. It's interesting. I'll just add this, Jason. A lot of new developments in the church in the West, for example, like John Mark Comer's Practicing the Way, are really significant tools, but they're not grounded as much in a theological vision. In other words, you wouldn't find a chapter on Trinitarian theology, for example. But I think once you take a step beyond Alpha, you need to introduce them the kind of coherence of a Christian worldview, all parts of it, integrated into a larger whole, but then immediately directed toward practice.
I feel like one of the things I notice, it seems so obvious to state, but I think is worthy of reflection, like, church movements seem to capture a piece of the puzzle. So you have a spiritual formation movement, and then you might have an in the same moment in history, whether it was in the 70s, the 90s, or now, you'd have maybe a theological movements, a resurgence of Reformed theology, or an emphasis on doctrine. And then you put over here an emphasis on mission and evangelism. And on their own, they're insufficient to tell the whole story.
Yeah.
But I think what's so fascinating about what you're describing and important is an integrated approach where there isn't a theological conversation here about doctrine or biblical theology, and then a practice-based approach over here. Maybe to put it another way, is to make robust whole disciples, we need those at play together in a formative process.
Well, that's presumptuous as this sounds, that's what I'm trying to do, is to return to the foundation, what I call the three greats, the Great Commission, the Great Commandment, and the great tradition of historic Christian faith. And the holistic nature of that. And not just the holistic nature of that, Jason, but the coherence, the comprehensiveness. I call it the three-legged stool of Christianity. You have to have three legs to have a stool. There's something essential about this, and that's what I want to communicate. To speak as a church historian, once you have a dominant Christianity that begins in the fourth century and grows from there, once that happens, most of the renewal movements in the history of Christianity are a reclamation of one aspect of Christian practice or doctrine. So whether that's the Benedictine movement of the sixth century, or the Franciscan and Dominicans, or different branches of the Reformation, or the Wesleyan movement, or Christian community movements in the 1970s, and so on and so forth, they're reclaiming one part that they believe is being sorely neglected.
Yeah.
So you look, for example, at the Christian communities in the 1970s. They were popping up all over the place. Most didn't survive more than 10 years. Or you look at the Wesleyan movement in the 18th century, where they were seeing people who had been somehow exposed to Christianity, but had not really stepped in to the degree that they want. So they created this conversion experience. If you had mentioned a conversion experience to the 16th century figures, they wouldn't have understood what you mean by that. If you had asked someone, well, when did you become a Christian? Almost everyone outside of the Anabaptists, which were pretty small movements, would have said, well, when I was baptized. Hmm. And what they mean by baptism is infant baptism. And then they would have said, I completed it when I went through confirmation. But the idea of a conversion experience with a kind of emotive quality to it was really an 18th century invention to be able to reclaim something in the history of Christianity that had been neglected, and that is lived faith, an own faith.
Yeah.
And so that became a prominent feature of what we now know as evangelicalism. I think that's going to fade over the years as we recognize there has to be something more thorough than simply an experience where you cross over the line and own the faith for yourself. More process-oriented, not merely experience-oriented. Not that it was wrong. I mean, I was converted at the age of 20, and I look back on that with a great deal of gratitude and fondness.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering now, in an increasingly post-Christian setting, if a conversion experience, as we have historically understood it, is going to be sufficient. I mean, I'll put it this way. Most people were former something. They were former Methodists. So they were former Anglicans or former Catholics or something like that. And now they're not as much former. So when you say to them, well, I want you to commit your life to Christ, their first response would be, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Mm.
And that is what inspires me about the old catechumenate. Can I go back again to early Christianity for just a minute?
Well, please do. And maybe I'll just zoom out for a second and say one of the gifts of your work, specifically Resilient Faith, which is a book I highly recommend. You know what's interesting, Jerry? Like, you know how you have books on a bookshelf at church or at your office, and then you have books at home? I just wanted to say, I have your books at home. Like, I didn't have to go to the office to grab A Grace Disguised, and we might be able to talk about the themes of this. This is the book I've given away as a pastor more than any other book.
Well,
by far, nothing comes close. And then I was able to pull this out, and I had read this leading up to the first time we got to meet, and I was able to thumb through it. And one of the gifts of Resilient Faith is, if I understand it right, your thesis is that as we experience increasing secularization today, we have great reason for hope and great tools to gain from the first, second, third century church. Do I have it right?
Yes, you have it right. Yeah.
And so within that context, as we find ourselves today, take us back. We can live there as long as you want in this conversation. I think there's lots that we can reclaim and will give courage by reflecting on the church pre-fourth century.
I believe that thoroughly. I mean, we can learn from every period in history. We can certainly learn from the early monastic movement. I'll actually turn back to that, I hope, a little bit later. And the mendicant movements of the 13th and 14th century and the Brethren of the Common Life and different aspects of the Reformation and Wesleyan movement and so on. All that's, civil rights movement, the social gospel movement. They all were rediscovering something that had suffered to some degree some neglect. But there's something thorough and fresh and original about those first few centuries. And I think we need to return and learn some things from them that are going to be valuable. So let me jump in and try to cast the story this way. All the first Christians were Jews, all of them. The movement was birthed in Jerusalem at the day of Pentecost when there was this great rush of wind, as the text tells us, and people were filled with the Holy Spirit. And after Peter's sermon, where all of his references were to the Old Testament, I mean, it was laced with Old Testament quotes because his audience was familiar with that story in that book and all those texts from Isaiah and Psalms and so on and so forth. And they said, what they were cut to the heart, what should we do? And he calls them to believe in Jesus and be baptized. And they formed their first kind of church or Christian community. Now, they carried their entire background and story into that conversion. Mm-hmm. They knew about the Old Testament story. They knew the figures. They knew the plot line. They knew about Abraham and the promise to him and the promise to David. They knew about Moses. They knew about Esther and Ruth. And they also had the theological categories, creation, fall, redemption, some notion of sin, some notion of social justice, so on. All of that was wrapped up, and they simply realized that Jesus was the final clue to bring the whole thing together. It's like they're finally reading the last chapter of a detective novel, and they have this aha moment when they meet Jesus. Oh my gosh, this is how the story is completed. And all the clues make sense to them for the first time.
Mm.
All right, so the step into Christianity was hard for them because they were Jews, and they had a certain understanding of God and their story. And they had to figure out how to integrate Jesus into it. But the story itself and all the categories of the story were already there in their souls.
Yeah.
And so once converted, a lot of it just made sense to them. Well, in the following decades, the Christian movement can't remain confined within Judaism and begins to grow. They begin to reach Samaritans. They begin to reach fellow traveling Jews, in other words, God-fearers, Greeks, pagans who were interested in Judaism and attracted to it, like Cornelius, for example, or the Ethiopian eunuch who on the chariot was reading what book? He was reading the book of Isaiah. I mean, this is a man, obviously, who is attracted to Judaism. But as they work themselves into the larger Roman world, all of that Jewish background began to be lost. Now, think about then what it would be like for a person who had grown up with Roman religion to convert to Christianity. They didn't know the story. They didn't have the categories. Their understanding of religion was so radically different from Christianity. All of these early Christians, pastors and elders and evangelists and just common folk who had committed their lives to Jesus had an enormous mountain to climb to introduce them to a world that was utterly alien to them. I put it this way, it's when you're learning, say, Spanish and you grew up in Italy, the step between those two Romance languages is significant but relatively small. Same vocabulary, a lot of the same. I mean, the similarities between those two language groups are very slight. It's very different when you're living in Italy or in the United States and you learn Chinese. Well, this was like learning Chinese. The gap between those two cultures, those two religions, was so vast that any kind of quick or easy conversion was impossible. So it's interesting to observe historically that when you see conversions in the book of Acts, baptism follows immediately. By the early to mid-second century, baptism is postponed for 2 to 3 years.
Why is that?
Well, you have to ask the question logically, why? That's because they didn't know what they were being baptized into. The gap was so huge that to baptize them into something would be like giving people an exam on Chinese when they've never been exposed to the language or they've only known it for a week or two. It's just too big. So they had to create a bridge between those two worlds, the world of Roman, traditional Roman religion with its many gods, its many temples, its monuments, its shrines, its household deities, all of its feasts and festivals, a very transactional religion with no real personal relationship with a god or gods or anything, into the Christianity that you and I know. That could not happen simultaneously. Now I want to jump back to what I think is the most important meeting that ever took place in all of human history, not just the history of Christianity, all of human history. It makes the Constitutional Convention of 1789 seem small in comparison. And this is it. I'll give you the context. It's utterly fascinating to me. So we know that the capital city of the mission to the Jews was Jerusalem. And we know that most of the apostles stayed in Jerusalem for at least a season before they began to fan out, Thomas to East, and so on and so forth. Eventually, when the mission to the Gentiles got some traction, they created a second capital city in a place that was closer to the world that they were trying to reach. And that city, of course, was Antioch. Antioch was in modern-day Syria. It had 18 different identifiable ethnic groups. It was a Roman city, not a Jewish city, although Jewish population was quite sizable. And the people who were leading the church in Antioch, we know their names, Saul, who became Paul, Barnabas, and some others. They were so successful in reaching Gentiles, not just in Antioch, but in other parts of the Greco-Roman world, especially in modern-day Turkey, back then Asia Minor, that it set off a controversy. And the reason is because Paul and his company of fellow evangelists and church planters decided not to require these converts from pagan religion to practice circumcision and to follow traditional Jewish food laws or dress codes or anything. And the leaders of the church in Jerusalem wondered whether this was a wise move. Was this separating too much from the parent religion and kind of the mothership, so to speak? So a group of Pharisaical Christians, yes, there were Pharisaical Christians, in other words, members of the party of the Pharisees who had converted to Jesus, sent a delegation from Jerusalem up to Antioch to see what was going on, to investigate and scrutinize. And while there, this is Luke's language, I love the understatement, there was a contentious debate that emerged. In other words, they got in a big fight.
It's a good euphemism, yeah.
They got in a big fight. I mean, it was you could tell it was very heated, just like the disagreement between Paul and Barnabas. And they finally decided to call a meeting down in Jerusalem with all the leaders of the church. And so the delegation from Antioch visited some churches on the way down there that had been planted. And they arrived in Jerusalem. And there was representatives from all these different parties to work this problem out. We know that there were Christian Pharisees there. There were elders. My guess is they're probably members of the Sanhedrin that had been converted to Christianity. We know that James, the Lord's brother, was there. Peter was there. Other apostles were there. And then delegates from the church in Antioch, the more radical wing of the church at this point. And it's interesting that notice that the sequence of argumentation. The Pharisees begin making a case for why the church had to convert, or Christians, converts, had to convert first to the culture of Judaism and then to Christianity and to Christ. And the argument would go something like this. Judaism is our mother religion. We can't make sense of Jesus apart from Judaism and its story. Those are two halves of a larger whole. But what they meant by keeping Judaism in play is following all of those Pharisaical customs, visiting the synagogue, following dress codes, eating a kosher diet, practicing circumcision, observing the Sabbath rest on Saturday, and so on and so forth, all of which these Gentile converts weren't doing. I think there's another reason that probably emerged that is not recorded, and it, to me, is the best reason. They would say something like this. You look at the power of the Roman Empire, and that Roman Empire had this amazing capacity to absorb religions into itself and defang them and domesticate them. In other words, they could say something like, we'll just have your God join the pantheon.
Yeah.
And we can allow for you to practice your own feasts and festivals, but it has to be integrated into the Roman way of life, you see. They believed that without Judaism, that's exactly what would have happened to Christianity as it did to the religion of Isis or Mithraism or all the other religions that were popping up all over the Roman world. In other words, Christianity in the end would be defenseless. Then they said with a wry smile, let's look at Judaism. Did Babylon conquer Judaism? Did Persia conquer Judaism? Did Greece conquer Judaism? How about Rome? Are we still standing? Are we still unique? Are we still a religion set apart? Do we still have clear boundary markers? Well, it's all of those practices that set us apart, that prevent us from converting to a culture. Now, to me, that's incredibly persuasive. I could hardly think of a way of arguing against that argument of saying we have to have clear boundary markers to set us apart and to protect us from being absorbed by Roman culture.
Yeah.
After they spoke, Peter did. And Peter only told a story. And it was the story of the conversion of Cornelius. Now, everything about Cornelius was antithetical to Peter. Here was a Roman centurion. He was a fellow traveler. He loved Judaism. He had built a synagogue, so he was a man of some means and some reputation. Jews loved him. And Peter had a dream, and it was only this dream of, you know, all those animals coming down in a sheet that persuaded him to go meet Cornelius in the first place. Then he begins to launch on a sermon, and before he's even done, the Holy Spirit falls on Cornelius, and he begins to speak in tongues. And Peter said, how can we withhold baptism, considering that what happened to Cornelius is the exact same thing that happened to us on the day of Pentecost? He tells this kind of significant metaphor story, a significant story that sets a trajectory for Christianity, and it's the conversion of Cornelius. Then Paul and his company simply tell stories of the conversion of the Gentiles and how powerful those conversion stories were. They were filled with the Spirit. They began to follow Jesus. They were in earnest. They were surviving even under persecution. There is evidence that God is at work in this Gentile mission, and we're seeing the fruit of it. The deal breaker was the last speaker, and it was James, the Lord's brother, the quintessential Jewish insider. We have no evidence that James traveled outside Jerusalem. None. Peter did. Certainly Paul did. Most of the other apostles did. James stayed there as the leader of the mission to the Jews. He stands up and sides with Paul and his company. We, he says, have lived under the burden of Judaism for centuries. We've not been able to fulfill the law as God commands us. Are we going to want to impose this same burden on Gentiles? But he qualifies himself in a significant way. He says, we want to require them to do two things. He doesn't mention circumcision. He doesn't mention a lot of other things that mark Jewish practice. He says, they need to refrain from idolatry. In other words, not including Jesus in the pantheon of Roman gods. And to refrain from eating meat with blood. Now, you think about those two. What he's saying is essentially this. We want them to defer to the needs of, quote, weaker brethren, Jews. We want them to be respectful of their own origins by doing something that would be highly offensive to Jews. Think Romans 14 and 15 here. And to make sure they don't commit adultery, at this point, think Ephesians 4 and 5. What you'll notice is he sets a trajectory theologically and ethically for the two wings of how Christians fit into culture. No idolatry, like sexual immorality, something like that, but also to be deferring to certain groups that would be easily offended by behavior that was too liberal. See? Mm. All right. So you have this big decision, no clear boundary markers. Well, then what are you going to do when you start doing evangelism in a thoroughly Gentile culture? You only have one option left if you're going to maintain the distinctiveness of the Christian movement. Only one option left. Fulfill the Great Commission. In other words, build disciples.
Hmm.
And that's exactly what we read in the New Testament. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed.
Come on.
And we all, with unveiled faces, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being, same word, transformed from one degree of glory to another, for this comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit.
Hmm.
In other words, the transformation of human life according to the image of Jesus. It's the imitation of Christ.
Hmm.
Not circumcision, not food laws. And by the time we get to the middle of the second century, we see this played out in a lovely document, the first apologetic document written in the history of Christianity. We don't know the author. It's titled by scholars, The So-Called Letter to Diognetus. And he simply describes Christian behavior.
Hmm.
What he describes is discipleship. He said, when you see a Christian in the marketplace, you won't know they're a Christian by their dress, by their diet, by the language that they use. They look like everybody else. But once you get to know them, they are really different. You notice it by the way husbands treat their wives. You notice it by the way they raise their children. You notice it that they practice hospitality. In other words, he describes the features of discipleship, not behaviors that create clear boundary markers between a Christian and the rest of the population.
Hmm.
In other words, Christians don't all wear red hats.
Mm-hmm. In Resilient Faith, you present this framework using the language of the third way.
Mm-hmm,
Can you unpack that a little bit? I find it so helpful. And I just love to hear you describe that.
That comes from that document, the so-called letter to Diognetus. He calls Christians, he says that Christians produced a third race of people. I can't use the word race anymore. So I said it was a third way, not Roman or traditional religious, not Jewish, but something different, something that created a new category of what it meant to be religious in the world.
Hmm.
That new way had to do with not simply trusting in Christ as the way to life, but also following Jesus and his new way of life, imitation of Christ. And that created a new kind of person in the world. A way of being generous, a way of being hospitable, a way of raising children across the board, a new way of being in the world. Now, I need to qualify myself, Jason, by saying not all Christians did this. There were as many failures then as there were today,
right,
as many churches that were unhealthy and all the rest. But they did figure out a way of functioning in a hostile culture for over 300 years and growing churches and planting churches all over the Roman Empire without being excessively absorbed by Rome.
Hmm.
So much so that at the eve of the last great persecution against Christianity under the Emperor Diognetus, or under the Emperor Diocletian, excuse me, there were, scholars estimate, probably about 5 million Christians, about 10% of the Roman Empire. And when they started out in, say, the year 50, there were maybe 5,000 Christians.
It's hard to process that, you know, because I think we take for granted all we, yourself, myself, know, unless we were raised for a considerable part of our life in another part of the world, which many listeners would have been, is a world that feels very full of cultural Christians, post-Christians. It's sort of in the milieu, or it's in the air. What do you feel is the application or significance today? When you take that language of the third way and you take it into our current moment, if you map that over our current moment, what's the significance now?
Well, I want to say that there were cultural Christians in the second century and in the third century. There's a new book that came out called Cultural Christians that say Christianity has always had an element of compromise built into it. But you can understand why, too, because think about the enormous challenge they faced in crossing cultural barriers. We know that the Christian movement began in a Jewish background. All the first Christians spoke Aramaic and Hebrew, or read Hebrew, spoke Aramaic. Then it was Greek. Then it was Latin. Then it was Syriac. Then it was Coptic. Then it was Goth. And now we're operating in several thousand languages around the world, not just languages, cultures.
Yeah.
And across those cultural barriers are really complicated. Mm. Every culture is different. And to negotiate how Christianity remains distinctive in that culture, it's going to look very different in one part of the world than another part of the world. They have to produce their own music and their own way of worshiping. They have to create their own kind of moral boundary markers. And it might look one way in one culture, in another way in another culture. So it's enormously complex. However, having said that, and knowing that you're always going to have compromise and controversy and so on, the fourth century was a big turning point in that once the Roman Empire recognized Christianity as legal and 70 years later embraced it as the primary religion of the empire, the number of cultural Christians grew exponentially.
Yeah.
And we know that because we can read the sermons of church fathers in the fourth century that complain about it all the time. And some of them are kind of sadly humorous. I mean, John Chrysostom complains that they go to worship in some beautiful building in the morning, and in the afternoon they go to horse races or chariot races and bet on their favorite team. He said, "What is this madness?" And they go to theaters and they do things that we would consider spiritually inappropriate. That has been the battle of Christianity since the middle of the fourth century, a kind of dominant cultural Christianity. And really, since then, almost all the renewal movements have been addressing a kind of Christendom that has lost passion for the gospel. One iteration after another, depending on the cultural circumstances. So what do we need to do? We need to go back and say, okay, what was the essential message of this early Christianity? What mattered the most to them? Because they're the first generation, or the first few generations, that are figuring out how to negotiate Christianity in a particular cultural setting. What was at the heart of what they believed? What was at the heart of what they practiced? What was what we call essential Christianity, or mere Christianity, or basic Christianity? The coherence and the comprehensiveness of that worldview and way of life, it has to be both. It was both. Two parts of the same whole. Both belief system and way of life, and actually a way of belonging in a community. And I think there's much we can learn there. It has to be Trinitarian in its theological orientation. It has to have a clear vision of Jesus, of being both completely divine but also completely human. It has to be deeply incarnational. I worked on a chapter today or this morning for a while. And you think about how odd it is that God chose to become human, and even more odd that he chose to become the kind of human he became. I mean, why not Alexander the Great? Why not Hercules? Why not Caesar Augustus? Why not Socrates? Why not Cicero? I mean, that's what we would naturally assume God would do. He would just come as kind of the biggest and best version of what humans can be. And then you look at how Jesus came. I mean, it's counterintuitive to everything we would expect God to do, and that's what God did. Well, that incarnation becomes a model of how we should function in the world. As servants, not as masters. I mean, even if we are masters, we should function as servants. If we're wealthy as well as poor, if we're male as well as female, if we represent the dominant culture rather than subcultures within the dominant culture, we always need to borrow from the playbook of incarnation. So there's so much richness you can learn from sermons and their books that help us to kind of rediscover what I'd call an essential Christianity and an essential way of life.
And what do you think is the imperative then for the pastor today? Not just from the pulpit, but in the organization of the life of the church.
Yeah, I think about this all the time, Jason, and I'm kind of creeping along here. I'm trying to piece this together. The reason why is because the pastorate today is still informed by about 1,600 years of church history. The structure of the church, the dominance of the sermon, a certain kind of professional protocol that they follow. But I think at the heart of the pastoral calling today is creating what I call a disciple-making culture within the life of the church that becomes a reproductive. It grows by multiplication, not by addition. All it does is fulfill the Great Commission and the Great Commandment. That's all. And to do that, you got to start small. You've got to grow it slowly. In order to create a culture that begins to be functionally Christian from top to bottom, from inside and out. Functionally Christian. And during the long reign of Christendom, we didn't need to do that. I mean, we could do it, and it would have been good if we did do it, but we didn't need to do it because Christianity was part of the air that people breathed.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't not be a Christian in the year 1200 or 1600, or really, for most people, even the year 1800. In America, in 1950, over 95% of the population still self-identified as Christian. Now it's below 70%. That's a precipitous decline in a very short period of time. So we're entering a different world. I'm sure in Canada, it would be less than that, certainly in the UK, and even more so in continental Europe. So I think we still kind of carry Christendom in our cultural memory, and it is informing how pastors do their work, which is not altogether bad. I'm not trying to dump the sermon here. It's an important part of the work of pastors. But to recognize that to create a discipleship and disciple-making culture, it's hard work. It needs to be slow and deliberate and grace-filled.
I'm going to attempt to try to find my way through here with my words because this is a new framing for me. Early on, you were talking about the work of inviting Jewish people to become Christians. They had the moral categories, the story, broadly speaking. There was a jump. There's obviously a defining change of heart and some allegiance, but there's all of this substructure in their imagination, all the way down to the neural pathways and traditions that would reinforce it. And I try, it created a parallel for me in my mind today that you just spoke to of like, how much of our disciple strategies were formed in a Christendom where there were ethical assumptions that we could make about how people perceive the world. And again, these aren't all necessarily all good or bad, but there was this baseline assumption. And then many of us, I'm a millennial, whole range of listeners, different generations, receive models of ministry that were formed in a moment where you could assume the journey was about surrender, the journey was letting the work of the Spirit animate their life, but you could assume an essential sort of set of even values or understanding of the story or ethics. And now today, what I'm experiencing here in the city of Vancouver and for many people is whether they have a Christian background or not, the deepest sort of wiring of their mind and heart is not first and foremost Christian at all. It's primarily secular. And actually the work of helping move them into the story of God and to see the world through the prism of that reality, I don't feel like I have all the tools or maybe let me put it this way. I don't feel like the models that we've inherited are sufficient to do that. Can you help me out with that?
No, I don't need to help you. That is so articulate, Jason. I want to start interviewing you now. Honestly, that is a very, very good summary of, I think, the challenge ahead for us is we are beginning to form deep neural pathways in our brains that are alien to a Christian worldview. And it was the opposite for so long. We had neural pathways, and we might be flirting with things outside of Christianity, and we would kind of integrate them into our neural pathways. So self-help would be a good example of this, where you'd borrow some self-help elements, but it would still be integrated into a set of nerve synapses and neural pathways where you believed in grace and forgiveness and lots of other things. But as those begin to be filled in and we create or cut two new neural pathways, or our brains function more like river deltas with river kind of moving everywhere, and there aren't any deep neural pathways, we face a very, very different set of challenges. Our task now is to literally create those new and deep neural pathways that we could have at least to some degree assumed for a very, very long time, many centuries. Now, again, I'm not suggesting every Christian for centuries was sincere. We don't know. We have no way of telling. But I do know that there was a kind of infrastructure, a cultural infrastructure that was friendly to certain elements of Christianity. You see it in the literature produced. You see it in the buildings that were built. I mean, it's everywhere. You see it in the way they formed universities and the way those universities function in culture for centuries. I mean, they still had required chapel at state colleges in the United States in the early 20th century. No, excuse me, early 21st century. I mean, the crisis in higher ed, which we're reading about virtually daily in America, right, is the reason why it's in crisis is that it's shedding its kind of Christian roots. And it's confused now. It's like a river delta. There's water flowing everywhere.
And it's like the moorings were holding it together more than people knew.
Correct.
Or these and then that. And it's like, hey, let's fully do away with them. And I think probably you and I don't want to put words in your mouth, might agree that this might be for best, like best to not perpetuate some sort of illusion that it's going on. However, what you see when you remove that substructure is a rapid eroding.
Yeah, yes, that is exactly right. It is, it feels more rapid. It feels more menacing now than I think it used to. Again, I don't idealize Christendom. I'm not a conservative in that sense.
Yeah.
I'm more of an historian that says it just was, and it had its own strengths and weaknesses. I mean, it produced an amazing array of literature. It created great institutions that it in many ways invented modern healthcare as we understand it today. I mean, there was much there that's good we're still borrowing from. Having said that, having a large, large number of cultural Christians is not necessarily healthy for the life of the church. But we don't have the luxury anymore of even assuming it. Mm-hmm. Not as much as we used to anyway. And so our work is different and really challenging.
Yeah, I think this is why so much of the conversation has moved towards questions of discipleship. Deep questions, how might we do this? And what's deeply encouraging for me is when somebody makes a decision to follow Jesus, a young adult in the city of Vancouver, and there's no social win to be had by that decision. There's a sincerity to it. And then the task, though, on the other side of, say, a decision or a season of a surrender to the Lord is then to not just say, okay, now do what you know is right. Mm-hmm. It's actually to say, now we must learn a whole new set of practices, ethics, worldview, story. And it's just not a fast process. And what I sense from a lot of my peers is in the best sense, a longing to have the conversation of how might we make resilient, robust, Christ-like disciples in our time.
I you're preaching to the choir here. I want to start interviewing you. You're so articulate in what you're saying, Jason, that's so, so significant. A story is a good example. I mean, there's a kind of story that we carry in our almost subconscious self. Again, it's these deep neural pathways. And stories have categories to them that help organize how we understand ourselves when we go through loss, or when we're offered a new job, or we have a marital difficulty, or whatever it happens to be. Story shapes how we respond. Not just how we think about our own story, but larger cultural narratives that we just kind of naturally breathe in. They're just part of our DNA, if you will. And when those stories begin to be lost, and they you don't have the same deep Grand Canyon neural pathways for them, you'll notice a kind of massive confusion. Notice some of the stories that are dominating our cultural setting now, stories of victimization, stories of entitlement, stories of deep resentment. I mean, the whole DEI movement right now, as it's been unmoored from a kind of Christian worldview. I mean, we have DEI all through our theology. Think about who's going to sit at the table of the Lord in heaven. People from north and south and east and west speaking thousands of different languages. There's diversity, equity, and inclusion. But it's not the same kind as we find in universities today. So one of the rebuilding processes we need to go through is to reintroduce the categories of a Christian story that will shape how we approach self-help movements, say losing weight, or how we approach diversity, equity, and inclusion, or how we approach politics, and so on and so forth. In our American setting, think about the difference between when President Clinton had a moral failure and evangelical Christians were up in arms, and all their public statements was that the moral behavior of presidents matters.
Yeah.
To today, 30 years later, it's a very different world 25 years later that we're living in today when it comes to how evangelicals are responding to Donald Trump. Now, that's not a political statement. You can vote Republican. I'm not. But in 25 years, there's been a massive shift in how we understand the kind of person we want as the leader of our country. So reintroducing the Christian story in a winsome kind of way, so that people can begin to understand their own stories in that light and step out of other cultural narratives back into the Christian narrative. I don't think we can assume it anymore.
I'm going to make a hard turn. I feel like if no one else, I'm sure everyone will deeply enjoy your commentary. I'm so grateful for this. I could park here for probably way too long, but I want to honor your time. And I also just want to bring some attention to a different theme and topic. We've been talking in and around some themes from resilient faith. You wrote a book that, in your words, has a life of its own. A grace disguise that came out of your own story of loss and grief and pain. And when I meet somebody, I'll just give you a couple examples. A dear friend is betrayed by his wife, finds out she's cheating. His world falls apart. Another dear friend loses her husband of decades. And, you know, as a pastor, there's no words. You never know, like there's just no words. And I'm always so hesitant to offer any kind of solution, but at the appropriate time, I will often with a note, mail them the book you wrote, A Grace Disguised. My grandpa just lost his wife, and he's just processing grief for the first time at this level in his 90s. And recently we're together, and this was the book I gave him. And mostly I just wanted people listening just to be introduced to it. Really. It just is such a profound Christian vision of navigating grief and loss this side of the new heavens and new earth, that doesn't shoo anything away, doesn't try to offer simple answers. It's just such a gift. I guess maybe I just wanted to say that to you and commend it, but I would love any just sort of reflections you have on what this book means to you and how you've seen it impact lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have. I want to say first a word about writing a book like this, but really writing any book. When you get done doing something, you have to let it go. I actually follow a practice, Jason, where when I'm done, I'll take the first copy that comes to me from the press. You always get the first copy. And I go to a communion table and I lay it on the communion table.
Hmm.
And I just sit back and I reflect on what it was like to write it, where it came from, the places within me. And God's call in my life. I just sit and think for a while. And then I release it to God. I say, it doesn't belong to me anymore. It's yours. And you do with it what you want to. Because I don't have any control over that. I don't know the people that are going to read it. I can't clarify anything. It isn't mine anymore. In the same way that a sermon, once it leaves your mouth, isn't really yours anymore. Things are going to happen that you will never know about, and some of which you wanted, and some of which you didn't even want at all. It's just the nature thing. I remember sitting in an airplane, flying from one place to another, and there was a couple sitting across from me, and another couple they didn't know sat in front. And one woman said to them, I just finished reading that book. And they had a 45-minute conversation about that book, and it happened to be A Grace Disguised. And I heard the whole thing, and I thought to myself, now, what do I do here? And I decided to leave the plane anonymous. I thought, if I intruded, what would I do but simply interrupt a moment of grace for those people? And that's what it should be. So I just want to say that it's just places and done things that I'll never understand. But I do hear from a lot of readers. And over the years, Jason, I'm going to say only one thing, because the conversation would have to go on too long. That would have to be another podcast interview. We have to learn to carry it. We never shed any experiences from the past, none of them. We're by nature time-bound creatures. We have memory, we have longings for the future, and we're stuck in the present and we can't escape it. And the secret is to learn to carry the past in a way that is redemptive. Carry it as memory, carry it as consequence. Not only the beautiful moments where there's triumph and blessing and life, but also the moments of greatest loss and acute pain. I finally came to the point of realizing I will never be able to escape this pain. That's not possible. And I shouldn't. It's a part of my story. It's a part of my being. So I have to figure out how to carry it in a way that's less debilitating, and even in a strange kind of way, life-giving. When Jesus was teaching the Beatitudes, he didn't say, blessed are those who once mourn and they'll be comforted. No, he said, blessed are those who are mourning. It's present tense. Mourning should be a part of a Christian lifestyle. There's a lot to mourn about, Jason. You know that. You're a pastor. And our capacity to mourn should grow as we become mature Christians. So we start to carry the pain of other people and not just our own. It's a kind of soul muscle that we have. And that soul muscle can grow just like physical muscles can, so that we learn to carry not only our own pain, but the pain of others. And at the same time, experience joy and peace and contentment, because the soul has that capacity for both. It took me a long time to land there, because what we lost was big. I mean, three generations of women in instant. It was really hard. I don't say that self-pitying. Self-pity just doesn't run through my nature. But it was really hard, and it took a long time. But I came to the point of realizing, I'm not going to outgrow this. I'm not going to somehow overcome it. I'm not going to get to the other side of it. I'm going to grow into it, and I'm going to learn to carry it. And I would say God has given me that capacity. I'm much quicker to tears than I used to be. I carry wound, but it's not a bad thing. There you go.
The story I think we tell ourselves sometimes in grief and pain is a little bit longer and I'll get over it.
Yeah.
You know? And it's, I think what you've helped me and others is to write a different script.
Yeah.
It's just, that's not the script. And so you're trying to find your way and you're so disappointed because you don't get over it.
Yeah.
And there's a picture that you describe in this book. If I recall right, it's about a stump in your backyard.
Oh, gosh.
Am I remembering right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you bring me to that scene? Because it served as a mental picture that tells a whole different kind of story about it. And it's the picture that I, when I'm praying for those who are grieving, that I have in mind, and that for myself and my own pain and loss, I hold. And could you take us to that scene and what that taught you?
Well, picture a big tree in the backyard, you know, the kind that you grow up with. You're a child, you play trucks under it, you have a sandbox, you have swings, you have picnics. It's got a huge canopy. You climb in it when you're older. You have a tree fort. When you're an adult, you look at it and just gaze with wonder at its beauty, its shade. You curse when the leaves are released in the fall or whatever, but you miss it during the winter and then see it bloom leaf out in the spring, and you're renewed in your appreciation for it. It's that kind of history, or that kind of tree that provides that kind of history for your family, and it gets diseased and you have to cut it down. And when you look out the kitchen window, all you see is a bare landscape. All you see is the absence of that tree. And that stump reminds you of what you lost. And you mourn because you miss it. All the memories associated with that tree. All those years of raising a family and enjoying it and climbing in it and picnicking and everything else, you know. And that stump reminds you of the loss. But one day you have this thought, I'm going to plant around it. I'm going to let the stump stay because that tree was important to our family story. And that trunk is going to remind me of that. But you plant shrubs and flowers, you grow a garden, and soon after a year or two or three, there's a kind of new story emerging of new life, of all those shoots and all those flowers and dahlias and roses and whatever it happens to be, a new planting that begins to grow, but it's around the stump. And it's the integration of those two, in my mind, that tells the Christian story. Jesus, you know, still had scars. Will there be wounds in heaven? Of course there will be. There has to be. That's part of our story on this earth. But they're going to be enveloped by so much grander and more beautiful. And that makes all the difference. Now, it's hard fought to get there, Jason.
It is. Yeah.
But it's worth it.
Yeah.
You know, I was single for 20 years after I lost my wife. 20 years. Raised my kids. Didn't do it perfectly. I'm not a perfect parent. To this day, I still miss my wife. And all that would have happened if she were still here. At the 30th anniversary, we always sort of observe it every year, the accident. I was having lunch with a couple of my kids, and I said, do you still think about Mom? And they said, sure, we do. And I said, do you still miss her? And they said, well, yeah, of course we do. But my son said, you know, the weird thing at this point is, I think about what it would be like if she were still here. The problem is everything we have now would not be here, or at least a lot of it. Would I have married the same person I'm married to? And if I hadn't, we wouldn't have the same kids. Would we still be here in Spokane? I mean, we don't know where that story would have led, but it wouldn't be what we have now. And I love what I have now, and I miss what's gone. Well, I remarried 13 years ago, and I loved my new wife. I say to her, you're my first wife the second time around. And I still love my first wife. That, to me, reflects a Christian worldview.
Yeah. Jerry, it's such a joy to be with you. I know most people are going to be listening. I have the privilege of seeing you. And I find great joy and comfort just seeing the delight you have when you talk about church history, about the Christian story, about resurrection, and the tenderness when you, and the smile when you talk about your family and your kids and your grandchildren. And I'm just so thankful for your life and ministry.
Yeah, thank you.
And that you're willing to give it away through time like this, and to pastors in Spokane and to Canadian pastors listening through your literature. And I look forward to spending time together again soon.
Thank you, Jason. It's been nothing but a pleasure.
Well, I want to thank Jerry for taking the time to share with us, to share his story and his wisdom. We're deeply grateful. A couple of the books we discussed in this conversation, I highly recommend. The first is A Grace Disguised, for those who have gone through the kind of suffering and loss, or those who are journeying with others through that. And the second is the book Resilient Faith. And you can find a link to those resources and more in the show notes on the podcast or at ccln.ca. I want to take a moment and give a special thanks to the team who made this podcast possible. Thank you to Nick Corbin and Will Lee for producing this episode. And these conversations, along with our gatherings, cohorts, and resources, are made possible by a generous community that seeks to strengthen pastors for the renewal of the church in Canada. If this mission of coming alongside and resourcing pastors is something that connects with your heart, would you join our giving community at ccln.ca/give, where you can make a one-time or sign up for a reoccurring donation. And lastly, we want to hear from you. Jump into the comments on Instagram or send us a note at contact@ccln.ca and let us know what impacted you from this episode and what questions has this conversation raised for you as you think about pastoring today. All right, that's all from me. Tons of love. Bye for now.